This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Reserve met today. Nothing happened, but often it's what the central bank says that matters more than what it does. So now that the recession is officially over, we are reading the interest rate tea leaves in a whole new way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service with the option to reach a human being at any time at 877-247-ALLY by pressing zero. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 21st of September today. And it's not like anybody was expecting the Fed to actually do something on interest rates at its meeting today. The key short-term rate that the Federal Open Market Committee controls, the federal funds rate, it's called, is going to stay right where it is, just about 0%. But Mr. Bernanke and his colleagues did offer a somewhat depressing view of the economic recovery. Marketplace Jeremy Hobson is on the line from New York with the Fed story. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Kai.
As always, when the Fed doesn't do anything on interest rates, it is about what they say in their statement. So what'd they say?
Well, Kai, they said the pace of the recovery has slowed in recent months and that it's only likely to be a modest recovery going forward. Also, that inflation is below the levels the Fed likes to see. In fact, they mentioned that twice in the short statement that they release. Now, having heard all that, you'd think maybe they're ready to announce some big steps. But it turns out all policymakers are prepared to do is what they called additional accommodation if need be.
Translate that for me, would you? Additional accommodation, what does that mean?
I don't think it means getting more rooms at the Ritz,
yeah,
but
right.
What it means, I think, is quantitative easing. It means the Fed essentially printing more money to buy even more bonds, try to push long-term interest rates down even further, and boost lending. Now, why aren't they doing more of that now? Well, I spoke with Bruce McCain, who's the chief investment strategist at Key Private Bank, and he says they don't want to make any sudden movements that might inject them into the 2010 congressional elections.
With the market showing some signs of stability, I think they feel they've got some time to sit back a little bit, try to get through the elections, not put themselves squarely in the middle of a political debate.
And Kai, Bruce McCain said if the Fed is going to try to help the economic recovery, it may do so later this fall. And the next meeting, by the way, concludes the day after the midterm elections.
Yeah, I saw that in the calendar today about that next meeting, which is actually kind of fascinating. But let me ask you this, Jeremy. If they're not going to do anything right now, or perhaps even before the elections, where does the Fed's actions stand? Where do they stand in terms of the whole economic recovery? Put it in context for me.
Well, we could be at the point where the Fed has done everything it's going to do to spur recovery. Now, if things get a lot worse in the coming months, obviously the Fed may step in with more action. But right now, one of the most important jobs of the Fed is going to be to instill confidence, because investors pay very close attention to the wording of these announcements. And the fact that the Fed didn't jump in with new measures today perhaps signals a certain degree of confidence in the recovery. I spoke with David Kelly, who's the chief market strategist at JP Morgan Funds, and he summed it up pretty well.
People know there's not much the Fed can do to help the economy out. So if they say they are worried or imply that they're worried because they're bringing some more medicine to the party, that's only going to scare people because people don't think the medicine can really work. So it's better for them to say as little as possible.
And Kai, he says, as long as things stay stable in the markets, the Fed will likely sit back and hope for the best. He calls them a very patient bunch.
Marketplace Jeremy Hobson in New York on the Fed and reading between the lines and what it all means. Jeremy, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Another part of the economy now, that which the housing market giveth with one hand, it taketh away with the other. There was some positive news on housing today. The Commerce Department said this morning that housing starts were up 10.5% in August. Double good news because a lot of economists were predicting another monthly decline. In particular, there was a big bump at the end of the summer in construction of apartments and condos. You take out those multifamily buildings, though, and the single-family housing market just doesn't look so great. And that is not so good because single-family houses are by far the biggest chunk of the market. And building permits for them, for those single-family houses, are the best way to figure out what future home construction is going to be like. They were down as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the news, both good and bad.
Harvard housing economist Nick Ritsinas was trying his best to put a good face on today's numbers.
The housing market, if anything, has better hopes than the Red Sox, which have no hopes, so it's faint praise.
Faint praise because the spring and early summer were pretty awful for home builders.
The numbers look good, particularly on the surface, because the previous numbers were just so bad.
Builders suffered as the government's home buyer tax credit expired and people curtailed their house hunting. Now they seem to be trickling back into the market, but very slowly, says economist Chris Christopher at IHS Global Insight. He says housing often leads the way out of a recession, but not this time around. Construction jobs have actually fallen almost 10%.
This recovery is homeless, if you will. There isn't a very strong uptick in volume and in prices because it was a housing bubble that burst.
And Nick Ritsinas says that's still a drag on new home construction.
We built a lot more homes than we needed, but we keep adding to the inventory with the continuing surge in foreclosures.
That lingering hangover from the recession helps explain one bright spot in today's report. Apartment construction is way up. That's as more people move from homes they used to own into rental units. Hessam Naji follows the market for real estate firm Marcus & Millichap.
The home ownership rate has fallen by 2 percentage points. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it's actually 3.4 million households coming out of home ownership and into the rental market.
Also feeding the demand for apartments and condos, young people leaving home as job prospects improve, and retiring baby boomers looking to downsize. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This is probably the biggest week for healthcare since the reform law passed earlier this year. A whole slew of provisions from that law go into effect on Thursday. Two of the biggest are that insurers won't be able to deny coverage to children with pre-existing conditions, and parents are going to be able to keep their children on family policies until they turn 26. But in response, healthcare companies have some new policies of their own, as Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
Insurance companies in a handful of states, including California and Kansas, have stopped offering child-only health insurance. These policies usually cover kids under 19 who aren't part of their parents' health care plans. They're often purchased by a guardian or grandparent. Linda Shepherd is with the Kansas Insurance Department. She says four major insurance players in her state have opted out of child-only coverage, including the biggest, Blue Cross and Blue Shield.
We certainly have no authority to tell a company that they have to offer this kind of coverage in the market.
In many states, insurance companies have also asked for rate hikes. Insurers say the policy changes and premium increases are directly tied to new health care reform changes. That's led many politicians up for re-election to call for the new law to be repealed altogether. Robert Zirkelback is with America's Health Insurance Plans, a health insurance industry trade group.
It's a basic law of economics that when new benefits are added to a policy or more people are added to a policy, that incurs additional costs that will be reflected in the cost of coverage.
But healthcare advocates say companies are using reform as an excuse to increase profits. Ethan Rome is executive director of Healthcare for America Now, or HCAN.
There's nothing about this law that warrants insurance companies to jack up our rates or drop kids.
That's sure to be debated tomorrow when 30 state insurance commissioners meet with President Obama to talk about healthcare reform. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, down to start, and then stocks went up when the Fed didn't raise interest rates. And then people actually read the Fed statement, and it's going to be the mixed music when we get there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you really think about it, what the Fed's trying to do when it meets to talk about interest rates is an amazingly complicated thing. Tease out what a $14 trillion economy is going to be like 6 months or a year from now, and then apply the right policies. Commentator and economist Justin Wolfers says forecasting the economic future truly is a dismal science.
Economists and meteorologists know that forecasting is hard. But at least when the weatherman is wrong, we just get wet. When economists get it wrong, we get the Great Recession. And so we economists spent much of the past decade developing a new generation of models. But two young researchers have raised big questions for this research program. They compared the track record of various state-of-the-art models and elite forecasters. What did they find? All the leading approaches to forecasting have been terrible. Translation: our forecasts of GDP, inflation, and interest rates have been way off. Here's a neat way of thinking about how badly these models fail. If in 1997 you'd trained a parrot to say GDP growth and inflation would be 3.5% and interest rates won't change, then your parrot would have done as well as the leading macroeconomists who fine-tune their numbers daily. Or if your parrot just says, "Whatever happened last quarter?" whenever he's asked for a forecast, he'll still do as well as those PhD-toting economists hired by the leading banks, but he doesn't need a salary. Academic economists thought we were smarter than your parrot. We've trumpeted progress in developing what we call, wait for it, dynamic, stochastic, general equilibrium models. They're not just a mouthful. They're also the result of a decade of intense research. But if you ask these models to predict the future, they're no better than your parrot. Now, statisticians don't pretend to understand the economy. They just crunch the numbers. But their models performed even worse. Perhaps you trust people instead of computers. But the Fed's economists were no better. And if you have greater faith in the private sector, you really shouldn't. Their prognostications were dismal. Now, you probably knew that most economists failed to predict the 2007 recession. What's news is that even after the Great Recession arrived, our complicated models failed to recognize the new reality. Bob Dylan sung it best. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. And according to this new research, you don't need an economist to know which way the economy goes.
Justin Wolfers is a professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. If you've got your own forecast of the economic picture, please send it in. We'll make sure it gets to the right people. Visit our website, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. In the Indian economy, what a person can do, what they can become, is not entirely in their own hands. The caste system there still plays a huge part in where you can go to school, who you can marry, and what job you're likely to get. The Indian government's latest try at elevating Dalits, or those from lower castes, isn't going over so well with private companies, as Raymond Thibodeau reports now from New Delhi.
India has long set aside a quarter of government jobs for the country's most oppressed castes. Now the government is mulling quotas for the private sector. It asked India's biggest 1,000 companies to disclose the caste of their employees. Fewer than 60 companies complied with the request. Chandraban Prasad is an activist and author from the Dalit community, India's largest, most oppressed caste.
Those companies that are not prepared to disclose, that means they don't have as many lower caste Dalits in their companies. If they did have more, what would they have to fear?
Prasad says it's too bad the government hasn't been forced to get involved in this issue.
Before government comes into picture,
the private sector should have come into the picture and said, now we are reforming the economy. We have a liberal economic setup. We should have a liberal social setup as well.
Prasad says even many big American companies operating in India have been slow to hire from among the lower castes. He says it's because many U.S. companies outsourcing to India are unaware of the caste system's complicated legacy of discrimination.
Caste system has survived for 2,000 years. It's a brilliantly conceived and brilliantly administered scam. It was all done to maintain the hegemony of a very small strata of society.
That's Narendra Yadav, a Dalit and a senior member of the government's Planning Commission for Economic Development. He says there's been some progress in moving India's lower castes into better-paying jobs, certainly in the public sector and to some extent in the private. But he says this isn't because of any concerted effort on the part of the bosses. The disadvantaged castes are making their own opportunities.
India is moving towards becoming an economic superpower. They have opportunity to educate. They have opportunity to make something out of their life. This process has begun. It is still a long way to go.
Yadav predicts there will always be caste distinctions in India. But he agrees with many business leaders who say that in the new, more urbanized India, discrimination based solely on caste is declining, but perhaps too slowly. Some big Indian corporations, such as Tata and Infosys, are starting to take notice. They've taken the lead in affirmative action hiring and training programs.
Tatas, in particular, believe that these discriminations should be erased.
Jamshed Irani is director of Tata Sons.
The Tata Group is leading this movement as it believes that it is the right thing to do for Indian industry.
Irani says private industry would be better off voluntarily hiring lower caste employees. Analysts say if it doesn't take affirmative action more seriously, India's government is likely to force it to. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Coming up, the meaning and the money behind one little pastry.
It's a way of showing respect to business partners and people that you want to be close to.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials inched up 7 points today, a fraction of 1%, finished at 10,761. The NASDAQ off 6 points, 0.25%, closed at 2,349. The S&P 500 gave back 2 points, also 0.25%, ended the day at 1,139. The Fed didn't budge on interest rates, as Jeremy Hobson was telling us, and that signal about the economy sent financials down. Morgan Stanley cashed out almost 3% today. JPMorgan Chase surrendered 1.5%. Citigroup gave back 1.25%. Carnival Cruise Line sailed up 1.33% today, that after reporting strong summer profits. ConAgra Foods scraped off 3.5% on disappointing earnings news. Other companies suffered from analyst downgrades. Monsanto withered 2% on the vine. SanDisk erased 6%. Whole Foods Market unpacked 2.33%. Newspapers took a hit as well. Gannett, the publisher of USA Today, rolled down almost 2.5%. The New York Times Company lost 5.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.58%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Budget Committee holds a hearing on the federal policy response to the economic crisis. A House Oversight and Investigations Subcommittee discusses the salmonella outbreak associated with eggs from Iowa. And it's the first day of fall. Pretty soon it will be Halloween and then New Year's Eve. Get working on those 2010 resolutions while there's still time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The United Nations General Assembly is meeting in New York this week. Among the high priority topics of conversation are the Millennium Development Goals. Those are the targets set 10 years ago to cut poverty and hunger, get the AIDS epidemic under control, and reduce infant and mother mortality rates worldwide, among others. There are 8 goals in all, and just 5 years left to meet the UN's self-imposed deadline. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on the line with more on where the UN is with its goals and what is left to be done. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
What progress have we seen so far on these Millennium Goals?
progress has been patchy. There have been successes. I mean, child mortality is coming down. Rates of HIV/AIDS infection have stabilized in most regions. But on poverty and hunger, this was the main goal. It's not really a success story. In sub-Saharan Africa, for example, the number of people living on a dollar a day has gone up by 92 million. And globally, the number of hungry people had risen to more than a billion last year.
These goals, though, Stephen, were launched a decade ago with great fanfare. We are two-thirds of the way through the program. What happened?
Well, it's the abiding problem with all aid summits and donor conferences, I guess. It's very easy to pledge. It's much harder to deliver. In fact, in terms of the amount of aid that the rich countries have handed over, it's gone up. I mean, there is a record amount now flowing from the rich world to the developing world. Last year, it was $120 billion, but that is still $20 billion less than the rich countries promised. The problem, of course, has been the downturn and the deficits. It does become more difficult for governments to tell their taxpayers, we're going to cut spending on healthcare and education at home, but we're going to increase spending on overseas aid.
Are there people having second thoughts then, Stephen, about how this whole thing was handled and taken care of?
Well, some people are, yes. I mean, the whole point of this process was to have targets and to have a deadline. The targets and the deadline were supposed to give shape and urgency to the drive to help the developing world. As we've seen, there have been some successes, and there could be more before 2015. But overall, I think many people are concluding that the results have not been very encouraging. And it has been suggested that maybe a better way would have been to take one goal at a time, spend a couple of years on it, do what we can to solve that particular problem, then move on to the next goal. But it's a bit late to abandon the eight-goal process. We're two-thirds of the way into the project. We have to press on.
Stephen, we are talking about this today because the United Nations is talking about it. But it does seem that in the interim, in the absence of big high-profile discussions, these goals do kind of fall by the wayside.
Yes, they do tend to get overlooked. There is, however, quite a lot of work going on behind the scenes and a lot of money, as we've seen, $120 billion flowing to the developing world. It's worth noting that the two developing countries that have done most to cut their poverty are China and India. But that's been largely due to their own self-generated economic growth. It has nothing to do with the Millennium Development Goals. Economic growth, ultimately, of course, is the surest way of beating these problems of poverty, hunger and disease.
Stephen Beard in London for us on the topic of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Kai.
There's a big festival coming up on the Chinese lunar calendar tomorrow. It's called the Mid-Autumn Festival. And for the past week or so, stores over there have been stocking up on the traditional gift of the season, mooncakes. They're pastries, small but rich, with a flaky crust and a sweet filling, usually made of lotus paste. But more than a billion people wanting the same thing on the same day? It smells like a business opportunity to me. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz takes us inside the mooncake economy.
Mooncakes have been likened to pastry hockey pucks. At around 1,000 calories, they're almost as dense. This helps explain why the Chinese don't buy mooncakes for themselves. They gift them. Sean Rain is a strategy consultant in Shanghai.
It's a way of showing respect to business partners and people that you want to be close to. And it's an also way to give them outright bribes.
Yes, bribes. And we're not talking about briefcases full of mooncakes, but their paper representations, mooncake vouchers. Here's how it works. Buy a voucher from a company that makes mooncakes, give it to your friend, client, local government official, and they, in theory, redeem the voucher for mooncakes. What most people do, though, is sell the vouchers on the black market for cash.
There's no embarrassment about saying that we don't want this mooncake. Let's be pragmatic and get some money out of it.
And when a fifth of the world is in on this, that money becomes an underground economy worth billions. Dozens of workers pack boxes of mooncakes at a Häagen-Dazs redemption center in Shanghai. 13 years ago, the company had an epiphany. They realized the Chinese give mooncakes, but many don't eat them. It's like the Christmas fruitcake dilemma in the West. So they thought, why not make ice cream mooncakes? The ice cream mooncake was born. Gary Chu manages the company's China operation.
It's a huge business. It's a very important business for us, and it's growing at a double digits every year.
Soon after, Starbucks, Nestle, and Dairy Queen got into the business. This year, Häagen-Dazs sold 1.5 million boxes. To buy one, you'll need $50 to $100 worth of vouchers. Want an ice cream mooncake this year? Sorry, vouchers are sold out. Your only option is the black market. A back alley vendor named Yin Jing wears a fanny pack full of Häagen-Dazs mooncake vouchers. They're made of thick paper. Each one has a laser-engraved hologram, just like currency. They float like currency, too. Last week, their price peaked. Now, with just days to go before the festival, Mr. Yin is looking to unload.
After the festival's over, all these vouchers will be expired, so I have no choice. I've got to start dropping the price.
This selling frenzy reaches the highest levels of society. Just blocks away, a vendor who only gives his surname, Zhang, just negotiated a deal on reams of vouchers.
These are all from government officials. They get so many as gifts, they feel too embarrassed to sell them to me in person. So they ask their wives to meet me in a coffee shop.
Fresh from his secret government rendezvous, Zhang's got his game face on, trying to sell all these vouchers before his time runs out. If he fails, he'll be forced to succumb to the spirit of the season by giving away dozens of boxes of mooncakes and keeping a few for himself, at which point the giving will stop and the losers of this annual game will be forced to eat. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Two things about those mooncakes real quick. One is that they're actually delicious, but 1,000 calories apiece? I didn't know that, so it's no wonder I gained weight when I lived over there. And also, if you want to make some, we've got some links to some good recipes on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of G. That was fast. You remember the case of Hewlett-Packard versus Mark Hurd, HP's former CEO who resigned under a cloud and then turned up a couple of weeks ago as the new president of HP's competition, Oracle. HP sued, said Hurd's new job would almost by definition mean he was giving up some of HP's most tippy-top corporate secrets. Much news was made of that lawsuit, which has now apparently gone away. HP, Oracle, and Hurd announced today they've patched things up. As long as we're talking about things going away, White House economic advisor Larry Summers is leaving. The White House announced this afternoon Summers is going to step down after the fall election. He's going to go back and teach economics at Harvard. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow inched up 7 points. That's a fraction of 1%, finished at 10,761. The NASDAQ off 6 points, 0.25%, 2349 at the bell. The S&P 500 gave back 2 points, also 0.25%, ended things at 1139. Thanks today to Ethan Lindsay and Rada Bead on our Morning Report crew, and that is where you can tune tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, tax breaks for fossil fuels. They are so old school.
100 years later, I think that it's time for these industries to leave the nest and stand on their own 2 feet.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.